May it please the Court, Andrea Rusty for the United States. The District Court erred in imposing a 12-month sentence in this case. The government alleged two violations of 1325A in the indictment, and the proper sentence was 6 months on count one and 24 months on count two. The District Court incorrectly concluded that the absence of an allegation that count two was a subsequent commission rendered the two-year stat max inapplicable. It is the government's position that intervening Supreme Court case law, Almendarez-Torres in this case, and this Court's decision in Pacheco-Zepeda have undermined existing Ninth Circuit case law interpreting 1325. It's the government's position that 1325 should be interpreted the same way as this Court has interpreted 1326, which would mean that the second or subsequent commission language was a recidivist sentencing enhancement.
Well, having a subsequent decision from our court is not quite enough under Miller v. Gammy, is it?
That's correct.
You have to have something bigger out there.
And
you think the bigger thing out there is Deal.
Or Deal and Almendarez-Torres in this case. Because we believe that 1325 should be interpreted in the same way as 1326. The statutes are similar in structure and purpose, and for that reason, because the Supreme Court found that the second or subsequent conviction language in 1326 was simply a sentencing enhancement, we believe the same applies to the subsequent commission language in 1325.
You're reading commission as the same as conviction?
Yes, Your Honor. Prior cases where this Court has interpreted 1325, this Court has held that commission should be interpreted the same as conviction, in that commission means actual conviction. And under the Supreme Court's holding in Deal, the district court's finding of guilt on count one will act as the prior conviction for count two.
As a matter of pleading, the information seems pretty clear that they're charging two, and one happened after the first.
That's correct.
Which makes it subsequent.
That's correct. If the Court has no further questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you very much. We'll hear from defendant.
May it please the Court. My name is Sean Kennedy, and I'm here on behalf of the appellee, Alyssa Rodriguez, who, of course, was the defendant in district court. And
was he happily pleading guilty until the district court came up with an issue?
This is true. And the issue is, in this area of the law, 1325A, which is sometimes called felony illegal entry, what is a sentencing factor and what is an element of the offense? Now, for 25 years in this circuit, that question has been answered. This Court has held that in felony illegal entry, the subsequent commission of this offense was an element of the felony charge. Now, today, the government, I believe...
I'm sorry, what case is it?
In a long line of cases cited in my brief, since I think the early 80s, the Court has repeatedly referred to the commission, the subsequent commission.
But you have to overcome the Almendarez-Torres. You have to overcome Deal, and then you have to overcome the Almendarez-Torres line of cases. So you need something subsequent to 93 and preferably subsequent to 98. Do you have anything like that?
No. And I think that's why we're here. And Your Honor, the judge's comment...
Why isn't this exactly a cross between Deal and Almendarez-Torres? Deal says you can charge them both together, even though there's no idea that you have to sort of commit one crime, go home, think about it, commit another crime. They can be just be two offenses, and it's exactly the same language. Close enough. And then Almendarez-Torres and our subsequent cases say this is just a sentencing enhancement. This is not another crime. They're exactly the same crime, but when it comes to sentencing, the court takes into account that there's more than one conviction. Why isn't this exactly the case contemplated by Miller v. Gammey, a situation in which we overrule our earlier precedent and conform it to the current state of the law?
Well, I'm going to try to answer that difficult question. My first comment is this, Your Honor. I think Diehl answers a question not raised by this case, and that is it possible to have conviction number one, the misdemeanor, and conviction number two, the felony, in the same indictment? And the answer probably to that is yes. I mean, that's what Diehl said.
Right.
But this case says, even if that's true, what should number two, count number two, look like? And should it contain, should it plead the element of the offense of a subsequent conviction? And I don't think Diehl answers that.
Let me ask you this. Let's say they were charged separate. Let's say there had been a prior conviction. Okay, so let's say the first count here weren't here, but instead of where we had a situation where she'd been convicted of the earlier. So now the government goes ahead and charges this crime again. What would it have to say in the indictment, in your view? Would the indictment have to charge any more than commission of this crime? Or would it have to say commission of this crime with a prior? And if so, you think you'd have to send it to the jury for the jury to decide whether she in fact had a prior?
Well,
What would that indictment look like in your view?
Well, I think it would look a lot like count two, with the addition of an allegation that this was a subsequent illegal entry conviction.
And what would happen when you went to the jury with that?
Well,
would the jury be asked to find this? Or find whether there was a prior conviction?
Well, I hope it would happen.
I'm asking you what you would,
what I think
would satisfy you so that you wouldn't take an appeal if it was done that way.
Well, I want to make it clear we didn't take this appeal, but, Your Honor.
I understand. I mean, the shoe's on the other foot. I'm just saying, how do you think that case would be handled? So if you were the defense lawyer, you'd say, okay, I lost, and the jury convicted anyway. I got everything I wanted, so I can't complain.
Okay.
So what is it that you would want to happen at that point?
Well, I would want what I see, and I'm not a state court lawyer, but I've been doing a lot of these petty theft with a prior type cases. Where, petty theft is ordinarily a misdemeanor.
You don't want to bring that petty state court stuff into federal court. We don't do that kind of thing.
But, I do, Your Honor, because I think it's very similar to
you probably here. Want lawyer voir dire, too, next.
Well, the thing is that we're not talking about just a sentencing enhancement. This really is moving up a class. We're talking about moving up from a misdemeanor offense up to a felony offense, and that happens in petty theft with a prior, and when it happens in state court, they do it the way I'm asking this court to hold that we ought to do it here, and I think that this court already has.
Can I ask a question here? Since we have Almendarez-Torres and Pacheco-Zepeda, they deal with 1926, right?
Yes.
So your whole argument rests on 1925 being different. The 1926, right?
Well, I think that's a large part of my argument. I'm not trying to not answer your... Well, I'll just tell you frankly, Your Honor, I think that... I don't mean any disrespect to the court, but I don't understand how Pacheco-Zepeda reconciles Almendarez-Torres with Apprendi. I don't think that the two can be reconciled truly. So, but if they are, as this court has held, then I think you've exactly stated my argument. And the reason that I say that, Your Honor, is not to be flipped, but, in Almendarez-Torres, it was a very close decision.
You won't be the only one in the world who thinks Apprendi and Almendarez-Torres are hard to reconcile.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. But if they are reconcilable, then I think the question is, if 1326B is a sentencing enhancement, then why isn't it 1325A, the felony part, the sentencing enhancement? And I think there are really good answers even in that, even when the question is framed that way. And the first I would say is this, which I've already mentioned, is that's a real bump up. We're talking about moving from a misdemeanor to a felony. And I think the idea that that kind of bump up is traditionally or ought to be considered a sentencing enhancement would be a pretty novel theory. I think that I can't, as we stand here, as I stand here, think of any other similar thing where there's a sentencing enhancement that converts something from a misdemeanor to a felony. And in fact, the Supreme Court has held in another kind of bump up where we're talking about non-capital felonies and capital felonies that those so-called sentencing, you know, enhancements or aggravators are elements of the offense that have to be approved beyond a reasonable doubt and fled that way.
Those are sort of death is different kind of cases.
Well, death is different sometimes, but I think in general the logic applies in the same way that when we're talking about moving up a class, it's different. It's different than in 1326B, where it's a felony to begin with. Under A, it's a felony. Under B, it's a felony. And the difference is the statutory maximum. Here we're talking about moving from a misdemeanor offense to a felony, and I think that's different.
Does it say misdemeanor felony, or is it just that the maximum penalty is within the misdemeanor range? And
Judge Kaczynski, you're exactly right. It just defines it. Now, out in the world, these traditionally, at least I shouldn't say the world, in my world of the Central District, I mean, these are often referred to as misdemeanor felony entry. And I mean, misdemeanor illegal entry and felony illegal reentry because of those sentences. And then there's the other reasons, too. And
what are the consequences of somebody being a felony as opposed to misdemeanor? No, 924C kick, or felon in possession. Was it 924C kicks in? What's other than the amount of time served? What is the difference between a felony and a misdemeanor?
Well, I'm not an immigration lawyer, but I know that.
I just mean in terms of general criminal law.
Well, I think being a felon and being a misdemeanor are very different, and probably the consequences that flow from the different convictions are big. Now, some aren't going to apply here because this is a criminal immigration charge. But, I mean, I do think generally they're considered differently, and I know they're considered differently in immigration law. I mean, there's a big difference when the person goes to immigration court as a misdemeanant versus when he goes to immigration court as a felon. And finally, I see I'm coming to the end. The whole structure of the two, 1325A and 1326B, I think there are real differences. These are both criminal immigration offenses. But, you know, in 1326B, one of the big things that was touted in the opinions is that it says criminal penalties under a separate section. And here it's really not like that.
Are we going to have to reject some prior precedent that equates 1925 and 1926 and says they should be construed?
Well, I don't think you're going to have to. I think that this court can definitely finesse that because it's really just one case, I believe, and it's said in passing. But when you look for the purposes of this question, which has become very different in the Apprendi world, they're really not the same. And one of the big reasons they're not the same, I think, is this bump up in class. That's a very different type of problem.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
They're here. It's just hard to see. That's supposed to. Go ahead.
To respond to Judge Rossani's question, actually, this Court would have to reject the Campos-Martinez case that it was the government's argument in that case that 1325 and 1326 should be interpreted differently, and this Court held that they should be interpreted in the same fashion.
Well, but, you know, differently in the same way, you know, you can interpret two statutes the same way for one purpose and differently for others, depending on whether they are similar or not. And what do you make of this distinction that Mr. Kennedy came up with here in the last minute between misdemeanor and felony?
Well, I think, first, the statute does not term them as such, and I think that...
But they are, in fact.
It does, in fact, as
defined for federal law purposes. And all sorts of things kick in if something is a felony, like felon in possession,
Correct.
And I think if you return after having certain kinds of felonies, if you come back in the country after having certain felonies, the punishment becomes much more severe. And I don't know what the effect on voting is in the state, but certainly some states, being a felon, even a federal felon, makes you ineligible for the vote. Why wouldn't that be a substantial enough difference to make it more than a sentencing enhancement?
I don't think that it changes the court's analysis. I think the fact that it puts the person into a different category does not change that it's meant to be a sentencing enhancement. I mean, there's nothing in the statute to lead the court to believe that Congress intended this to be an element. So I don't think it makes a difference. I think it's an unfortunate consequence, perhaps, for the defendant, but clearly, just as in 1326, although 1326, they are both felonies, I think the court intended it to be a sentencing enhancement. The additional requirement of having to prove the prior conviction doesn't really change what you're going to term the second conviction. So I don't think that it changes the analysis.
You don't have any law on this one way or the other.
Not on the difference between going from a misdemeanor to a felony, no.
Okay.
Thank you.
There appear to be no further questions. Case Josiah, you will stand for a minute. And I guess you, Ms. Lucy, can just stay put. Are you the mistress of the blue brief?
So
the unusual government blue brief. We'll hear next the case of United States versus Bonas.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Kia Kato on behalf of Mr. Bonas, and I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of my time. As the Court's aware, this case concerns a defendant's constitutionally protected right to be tried once by the first jury impaneled to hear his case. And just because the trial court grants the government's request to, quote, utter the magic words, manifest necessity, doesn't mean that manifest necessity is, in fact, present.
Sort of like Harry Potter, you know?
Excuse me?
Like Harry Potter, if you utter the right charm.
Exactly. Magic words, magic dust, you need much more than that. You need manifest necessity, and that you need facts and evidence in the record to support the court's finding of manifest necessity. You need something extraordinary. You
is it a finding? Is it a conclusion of law? Is it the exercise of discretion? What is it that this thing is?
Your Honor.
How do we review it? How much deference do we owe the district?
Your Honor, I think certainly the courts do state that you must afford a trial court deference. However, that must be limited, and it must be limited.
Is that what we usually say as we're reversing, affording deference to the learned trial judge? What does that mean, deference?
Your Honor, I think it's a recognition of the trial court's unique position, but of course, that position can't be abused. And where the trial court makes a finding or a conclusion that is not supported by facts in the record, as it did in this case, then this Court must reverse. And
what would you think the district judge should have done differently than he did?
Your Honor, I think that many things should have been done differently. But to start with, there should have at least, at the minimum, been a colloquy between the judge and these jurors to determine whether or not there was, in fact, manifest necessity.
But wasn't the judge reluctant to push the jurors too hard for fear that in other words, you bring these four jurors in and grill them, it's obvious where that's coming from. It's coming from the parties. And if they don't get what they want, which is to be released to go back to pay their mortgages, they're going to be madder than hell.
Your Honor, I don't think it's any different than traditional voir dire. You have the jurors pose an issue. We might not get paid by our employers. There's a subsequent colloquy between the court and these potential jurors to determine whether or not that issue rises to a level of preventing them from being fair and impartial juries. So
is there any suggestion directly to the district judge that that should happen?
No, Your Honor. And, in fact, I would suggest that this argument that the government makes, which is, well, defense counsel never asked for it, is misplaced. The judge takes the bench and says, here are the facts. I believe that's manifest necessity. The burden is on the defendant simply to object. Object, oppose the mistrial, and essentially say, that's not manifest necessity.
But now you're saying that more should have been done. And it seems to me that the way we usually approach claim trial error is to say, was it or how much of it was brought to the attention of the district judge? That's the place to cure it. You have everybody right there in the room, and then you tell the district judge, Judge, you can't do this without giving us a chance to voir dire these jurors and get a ruling.
Your Honor, the burden, and the courts are very clear about this, the burden and the duty lies with the prosecutor and the judge to establish facts in the record to support a finding of manifest necessity.
But if the burden's on the defendant, when the defendant alleges error here, to show that that error is in the record or was presented to the district court. In other words, our view, at least it seems to me, is that we have a difficulty reversing a district court on an error that was not brought to the district judge's attention.
Your Honor, certainly the error was brought to the district court's attention when defense counsel, which in this case was myself, said, no, we object. And at that point, the implied message is, there's not facts in the record to support this court's decision.
You admit that if you had to do it over again and you knew what questions you were going to be asked today, that the wiser course for you to have done at that point, and, you know, none of us are trying a case right now, so it's always easy to second guess what should have happened, but it would have been wiser to tell the court, no, Your Honor, we request that the court bring each of these jurors into court and voir dire them on this issue individually.
Your Honor, in hindsight,
That would have been the better course.
I'm not quite yet ready to concede that point, because the burden is on the government to establish a complete record to support manifest necessity.
You certainly have a much better answer to Judge Nelson's question if you'd done that and the court said no.
Well, I think the court's correct, but again, it's misplaced, because it's not up to the defense to say, that's not manifest necessity, but assuming you have the facts to support that finding, here are all the steps you should go through, Judge. That is not the burden. That is not the duty of defense counsel. It's clear that it is the burden and the duty of the government to make that record. It is not our job to point out to the government in which ways the record are deficient.
Your position, if I can paraphrase this, your client, or you on behalf of your client, have said, this is my jury. I'm entitled to go to verdict with this jury. And if anybody wants to take it away from you, they have to make a record.
Exactly.
That's your position.
Exactly, Your Honor. And it's not simply me saying, this is my jury. It's the Constitution saying, this is your jury.
Well, I understand. It wouldn't do you any good to say that unless you have the Constitution or something behind it.
And again, you know, in order to override that very...
May I ask you something here? It seems to me the judge comes into court. He says, I could talk to all these people. This is what they've told me. And I don't think they can be fair. At least that's one way you could read the transcript. And it seems to me that if you don't do anything, you're basically saying, I accept that the judge's factual finding. And then your only argument at that point is left, the factual finding the judge made, which you can't, the argument would be, you can't object to now because you didn't do anything about then. So you accept his factual findings, so now your argument is, as a matter of law, those factual findings don't amount to manifest necessity.
Your Honor, when the court came out on the bench at the time the mistrial was declared, the only issue raised and the way that issue was framed was, these jurors will not be paid by their employers.
You should answer Judge Vestani's question. I don't think you're answering her question.
I hopefully I'm getting there.
That was the factual finding. Now that there wasn't any factual finding that that they could not be fair and impartial. Okay, I'm saying, assuming what interprets the record as being a finding at that point that they could not be fair and impartial, then your only I would think the only thing left you would be to argue what the judge did there does not amount as a matter of law to manifest necessity.
Your Honor, I think we actually still could argue that the record before the judge did not support that finding. For example, if you have a judge come out and say, well, you know, defense counsel is wearing red, and I've heard four jurors say that they don't like the color red, therefore, I don't believe they can be fair and impartial. Clearly, that type of logic would not be upheld because it's not supported by any evidence in the record.
I thought you were making a different argument. It's not a question of logic. You're simply saying there's no record. There's no record to be – I mean, let's say the district court has said, I have made findings. And I thought your argument was, well, maybe the district court did make findings, but since we don't have a record on which to review those findings, there's no evidence to support it.
Your Honor, I think it's both a problem in terms of logic and in terms of the record. The record is deficient. But in terms of the logic that somehow all four of these jurors would face such an undue financial burden as to prevent
them. We don't know. I mean, I think it really, really collapses into the question of whether the record supports it. For all we know, all these jurors would have said, you know, we can't sit here. And if we're made to sit here even one more day, we're going to take it out of Mr. Bonas by finding him guilty even though we know he's innocent.
Sure.
There would be nothing illogical about a judge who had gotten that kind of answer finding that there was manifest necessity to dismiss. So really, your argument collapses to an absence of a record supporting the district court's findings. Isn't that what it really comes down to?
I think the court's correct. Of course, we can envision a world where these facts were, in fact, present, putting aside the problem with having those conversations off the record outside the presence of counsel and the defendant. Of course, you could, under some circumstance, have that. But again, as the court just pointed out, the issue is that conclusion, that finding, is not supported by the record.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You ended just at 0 minutes, 0 seconds. Thank you. We'll hear from the government.
May it please the Court, Andrea Russi for the United States.
Can I ask you a question? It seems to me that during the trial, I didn't really see the judge make a finding that these jurors were impartial. I saw a hint of that later on when they're talking about but can you tell me where exactly the judge is finding that these jurors cannot be fair and impartial was? I thought it was a little vague.
The judge, at the time that he declared a mistrial, he stated that after he asked to hear from the parties,
do you actually state then that he had decided after talking to these people that they could not be fair?
Well, what he said, and this is at the excerpt of record, page 272, he said that.
Line what?
Beginning on line 1, but I'll be reading from line 5. That he'd made contact with the four jurors, asking them whether they
could. Well, he doesn't say. I mean, you've misquoted here. He didn't say he has made contact. He said we've made contact. So he's either using the royal we or
I would assume it was either the judge or his courtroom deputy probably made the contact.
Right. So we don't even, at least to read this literally, we don't even have an ear witness. We have a statement by the judge based on a hearsay account of at least one intermediary.
Possibly.
Just to be entirely correct, accurate as to what the district court represents here. But go ahead.
On line 8, he says, I thought that we imposed enough pressure on them, short of some reaction by these jurors, that can adversely affect the parties here. Then the court consults further with the parties, and the government asks the court.
I'm sorry. How does that answer?
Well, he doesn't.
How does that answer Judge Rustani's question?
At the time he initially declares the mistrial on the 15th of November, he does not use the words fair and impartial on that day. he says that they've made contact with the jurors and he felt that any further.
No, no, I understand that, but I'm just wondering, what is it that he says in substance that would say he doesn't need to use the magic words, but here it is, he has, you think the sentence, I thought that we imposed enough pressure on them, short of some reaction by these jurors that can adversely affect the parties here?
Well, I think that there's actually later in the record at page 274, which is also the date that he declares the mistrial.
Okay, what line?
Line 6, he says, I cannot see how we could continue to proceed in this action unless we force the jurors to continue to serve. If that happens, I don't think we are going to get the kind of results that we should. By that, I mean a fair trial for all parties concerned. On that basis, the court does declare a mistrial.
Okay. Well, so you find that a finding of manifest necessity?
I do. I believe that he is.
Assuming it is, and I'm not convinced, why is it correct? The Supreme Court has said that jurors have to serve even if it's a financial hardship. So they couldn't even be dismissed for cause. Right, that's what's the name of that case? I'm sure you know it. The 1946 case, Teal, maybe, was it?
You're correct, Your Honor, that financial hardship is not
so. Why is the fact that they might have to be without pay for 5 or 6 days? I mean, I sort of don't get it.
I think that if the court's finding was based on, if he said these jurors are not going to be paid, therefore I'm excusing them, we would not have enough. But what he found was that based upon their financial hardship, they didn't have the state of mind that he believed that this was going to adversely affect the parties and the process. And it's hard to know.
Well, I'm not sure I understand. I mean, putting aside for the minute the huge problem you have that none of this is in the record, and I tell you this is probably going to be dispositive, but putting that question aside, we have jurors here who were voir dired, and the last thing that came out of their mouth on the record was, we can be fair and impartial, and we have nothing personal to us that wasn't asked that might affect our ability to be fair and impartial. That's the last thing we have that comes out of their mouth on this record. Now, sure, they might be ticked off, and they might wish not to serve. Lots of jurors prefer not to serve, and lots of jurors may be angry at the world, at their employer, at the court, and who knows what, if they're forced to serve anyway without pay. But the last thing we have from them is their sworn statement on the record, and they are sworn, as you know, that they can be impartial. What reason do we have for believing that whatever anger or unhappiness they feel will undermine the sworn statement they made that they can be impartial, and that whatever they feel cannot be cured by an instruction, which I know the government is always happy to say, you know, the juror is instructed, and they say, I understand, they will follow. The juror be said, you know, the judge says, look, you may not take this out on the parties. You can be angry at the court, you can be angry at the employer, you may not take it out on the parties. And the jurors say, yes, Your Honor, we understand, we'll follow. Now, what reason do we have to believe that that is not the situation here?
The only reason that we have is that Judge Takasugi said on numerous occasions it was his belief that these jurors could not carry out their duties and that it
would... But based on what? I mean, the only thing we have from these jurors is a statement, quite unequivocal, that they can be impartial. I'm having a difficult time. Without a transcript, without knowing what the jurors said, I remember we're only talking about two, not four. You could lose as many as two of them and still be okay because you had two alternates. Now, of course, we don't know who talked to them. We don't know what questions they were asked. We don't know what answers they gave. We don't know how they would have reacted to an admonition by the court telling them that they must be impartial regardless. Is that? I mean, I just have a very hard time finding manifest necessity in these circumstances.
Well, it's.
I mean, finding a support, rather, for the district court's determination of manifest necessity.
What I think is required is that the district court is entitled to discretion that he.
Well, let me ask you something else. Do you have a single case that you can cite to me where a court has made finding based upon stuff that he learned through the rumor mill in the courthouse that's not based on evidence on the record? Where you have no idea, we are unable to review whether the district court is making it up, misunderstood, or anything else. We have no transcript. We have no formal examination. We have no opportunity to either cross-examine or suggest further questions to the judge, or even a chance to review what the witnesses said to make sure that, in fact, what they said is germane to this. Can you cite to me a single case in the history of the common law, going back to King John?
The closest I can come is this Court's decision in the Jarvis case, where...
Oh, this is a Ninth Circuit case. Okay.
Yes. where the jurors saw four of the defendants being transported in shackles, and in that case, the district court did not make any inquiry of the jurors as to how this affected them, what their state of mind was.
But that is a little bit different. Saying that the district court has looked at it, at that point we are looking at the same record as a trial judge. And, you know, we may agree or not disagree, but anyway, Jarvis is the law of the circuit, but I can certainly see, well, but I'm asking you really a different question. Here, we're asked, I mean, you can play it one of two ways. You can say, look, the district court made findings based on stuff that happened in chambers, which is what you've been doing. You could also say there's manifest necessity from the known facts, from the known and undisputed facts. We know, and I think defendant doesn't dispute, that they would not be paid. And that established manifest necessity and so on. If you want to do that, we can go down the Jarvis road. But the question really I had for you is, assuming we have to rely on what the district court found based upon his fact-finding? I don't know what you call this. District court corridor gossip? I don't know. I don't know who's in there. Assume we have to rely on that. Do you have a single case anywhere in the history of the common law where a reviewing court has upheld findings by a trial judge where there's no record? There's no evidence even that the court, that the judge himself observed the witnesses, in this case jurors, the speakers, personally, but that it may well have been through an intermediary or intermediaries. Is there any such case?
I can't go as far as the history of the common law, but in my research, I did not come across a case where there was – I didn't come across a case that was identical to this circumstance.
French law?
I could look.
Supreme Court has been recently very generous in citation. But this would be very strange indeed to uphold manifest necessity, a constitutional right, one we consider to be one of the most fundamental rights that a defendant has at trial, and that is the right to stick with the jury that has been impaneled in his case on something this flimsy.
Well,
this is just one of those cases where the district court goofed, and you're stuck with it, isn't it? I mean, it's just too bad. It seems like this is a bad guy, but there's really no way around it, is there?
I would not agree that the record is entirely flimsy. I think the district court actually tried to do...
Well, let's say that defense counsel disagrees, wanted to say, look, the district court was clearly erroneous in its findings. Let's say she wanted to do that and wanted to argue to us, look, what the four jurors said really was misinterpreted. How could you do that? And how could I satisfy myself that Judge Sagosuke didn't just invent this? Not that he would. He's a very fine jurist and all that. But I can't take his word for it. I have to review. How do I review? How do I know that he didn't misunderstand or that he asked the right questions, or that even he personally observed the witnesses. How do I make sure that that's the case, so that when it comes around to saying, gee, this is a finding by district court, I'm satisfied, yes, you know, this is a good finding supported by substantial evidence. How do I do this?
I think that you're correct, that there is not, that the record doesn't contain the specifics of what the conversation he or someone in his staff had.
We don't even know that there was a conversation.
Well, he said that.
He's not under oath. We don't even have sworn testimony as to that, do we?
No, but
so normally the way evidence, if you want to rely on evidence, the way evidence comes to the record is somebody gets on the witness stand, raises his right hand and swears. All we have is the district judge. I mean, the district judge, let's say, fibbed about this. Not that he would. I'm just saying, you know, if he did, he wouldn't be subject to perjury. You couldn't prosecute him for violating 18 U.S.C. 1001, could you? I mean, it would be very difficult.
But I think that this Court has to assume at a minimum that what the judge relayed to the parties was
Why? Why do we have to do that?
Because he's entitled to discretion in this case. I think that
this discretion to make finding based upon stuff that happens in chambers without a reporter, without counsel present?
Well, to some extent, this is a circumstance where, as Judge Nelson pointed out, it may have been difficult to bring the jurors out and question them further without
Perfectly fine. You just bring them one at a time. It happens all the time. You just ask them questions. And then you instruct them. You say, look, Mr. Juror, if you are angry about this at anybody, you be angry at the court. But I instruct you not to be angry at the parties and not to take it on the parties. Do you think you understand this? Yes. Do you think you can follow? Yes, I can. No, I can't. Happens 100 times in district courts all over the country every day. You've seen it happen dozens, scores of times?
Judge Takasugi did not think that was the appropriate course here.
But he was probably wrong, wasn't he? I'd love to affirm in this case. show me how. Given what doubts I've expressed, why don't you persuade me?
I think the best that I can do to persuade you is that Judge Takasugi really attempted to do everything he could in this case.
But this is a constitutional right.
It is.
Trying hard doesn't count. You have to actually succeed. You have to actually make a finding on manifest necessity. And a finding, as I've always known as the case, has to be something based on the record.
Well,
of which there is none here.
I don't.
I'm, you know, that's what I keep running up against.
Right. And we do lack, there is no information about what the jurors told him. There is, however, information about all the
things. What if he misunderstood? What if they told him things and he is a little hard of hearing and he just didn't quite get it? I don't know. I don't know Judge Takasugi's state of hearing, but.
Well, he did mention at the beginning of, in the course of the mistrial hearing, he mentioned that these jurors had repeatedly made comments to his courtroom deputy.
Did he say anything about that they would be fail to be impartial? Did they say that?
Well,
or that they would take it out on the defendants? Maybe they take it out on the government. Maybe an impartial jury or a partial jury is exactly what the defendant wanted. Since it was his jury, maybe he thought a jury that would be angry at the government was a good jury for him.
He, on more than one occasion, said that he was very concerned about the rights of the parties, particularly the defendant. He was concerned that these jurors were going to hold this against the defendant and the defendant would get a fair trial. He was acting
for the government that brings the case. If you were going to sort of just guess at it, I would guess that the jurors would be angry at the government, no?
All I can say is that he believed it would adversely affect the defendant, and that is the reason he declared a mistrial here.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. You're plumb out of time. Would you like 30 seconds for a bottle or something, or would you just want to let it go?
Your Honor, unless the Court has any questions.
Case is argued, stand submitted.